Good news, all. There is not gonna be a trade war. Right now, anyway. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosedahl. Monday, the 26th day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This was actually a pretty big day in the evolution of the Trump administration's trade policy. First of all, the White House has made its first big bilateral trade deal, a renegotiation, to be clear, of the arrangement that the United States has with South Korea. Seoul will be the first to be permanently exempted from the president's steel and aluminum tariffs, and in return, agree to various quotas on its imports and exports. Meanwhile, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said this weekend he is actively speaking with the Chinese government about that bilateral relationship and maybe getting Americans better access to Chinese consumers. It is looking, bit by bit, more like managed trade than trade policy by tariff, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
Think back to the last time the U.S. did something similar, George W. Bush's steel tariffs in 2002. Doug Irwin is a trade historian at Dartmouth College. He says back then, tariff exemptions were granted pretty liberally.
From the Trump administration, it's become a much more political process. There's much more back and forth. Well, what can you do for us to get an exemption? It's not sort of this automatic or relatively routine administrative function.
In the newly renegotiated Korea Free Trade Agreement, South Korea agreed to give U.S. automakers better access to its markets and cap how much steel it exports to the U.S. It'll now sell only 70% of its average exports over the last 3 years. Dan Eikenson with the Cato Institute says this administration is being much more aggressive than its predecessors.
It's the U.S. flexing its muscle, and we've always had the capability to do that. We've always had the leverage to do it, but the previous 13 presidents thought better of it.
He says from President Roosevelt through President Obama, the U.S. adhered to the philosophy that reducing trade barriers was good for everyone. Trump's strategy is based on a premise that imports are bad, especially when we import more than we export.
He's looking for trade balance, not only between the United States and Korea, but within the auto sector and within the steel sector. So that is hyper-micromanaged trade policy, and it's a fool's errand.
After all, Eikenson says, the whole point of trade is for countries to specialize. Export the stuff you're best at making and import what others do better. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
I was talking to a steel guy today, actually, and he said he's got some hope that with the South Korea news, the situation in his industry is going to calm down a bit from the crazy couple of weeks it has had. That need for certainty applies elsewhere, of course. Exhibit B, I guess it is. Today is automotive. This week, we're expecting the Trump administration to begin the process of rolling back some Obama-era fuel efficiency and climate rules for cars and trucks. By all accounts, the new fuel economy standards are going to be targeted, something American carmakers have been asking for. But there are going to be lawsuits and new regulations take time. So if you are in the business of making cars, what future do you bet on? From the Sustainability Desk, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
The upcoming effort to undo fuel economy standards is about to run into a couple years of lawsuits, process, and rules. Not a fast-moving powertrain. Janet McCabe ran the EPA office in charge of these rules, and now she teaches law at Indiana University. She says the automakers asked for this relief, but their suppliers did not. This industry is split.
Not just the automakers themselves, but all of the different entities that participate in the chain, you wouldn't expect them all to be in the same place, and indeed they're not.
This fight will grind on not just in D.C., but likely California. It has special permission to set strict emissions rules, and 13 states have gone along. So EPA head Scott Pruitt would have to rescind that permission, too. UCLA law professor Ann Carlson.
If the Pruitt administration rolls back the California standards, we're going to see yet another battle where the states are suing EPA.
So in the end, what does U.S. industry do? Simple, says independent auto analyst Alan Baum. In general, he says they're investing in a low-carbon future because they're global makers in a global market.
If you look at the European Union and perhaps most importantly, China, that focus on improvement in fuel economy remains in place. And so both the automakers and the supply community, they'll continue down this path.
If any fuel economy rules change here, they'd begin in model year 2022. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The warranty period on that no trade war thing I started with, by the way, 12 hours from right now. Wall Street, as we know, though, lives in the moment. With the caveat that I don't get to decide, I'm guessing it's the really happy music when we do the numbers. The Federal Trade Commission issued a press release this morning, the operative part of which goes like this. The FTC takes very seriously, it says, recent press reports raising substantial concerns about the privacy practices of Facebook. Today, the FTC is confirming that it has an open, non-public investigation into these practices. End of quote. Practices that, of course, came to light a week or so ago after the news that Cambridge Analytica had leveraged a personality test taken by 270,000 people to scrape data from 50 million Facebook users. That jump from 270,000 test results to Cambridge's claims of widespread election influence is what interested us, so we put me on the spot.
The way to do this test is to sort of relax, kind of center yourself, and be honest.
That's Stephen Cobb. He's a researcher with the cybersecurity firm ESET. He has studied the personality test that Cambridge Analytica used, and he sent me one that was similar. All right, so I'm going to click on this little start button.
Go for it.
Oh, man. Let me just describe it for folks. And it goes like this. I've got on my computer screen in front of me I don't know, there's probably 25-ish questions here, of which they're one sentence. And the first one is, I am the life of the party. And then the answer options are disagree, neutral, agree. And there are five gradations between disagree and agree. And I'm just going to start clicking, and we'll see what happens.
Okay.
All right. So question number one, I am the life of the party. There we go. Okay. Statements like, I often feel blue, and I am not interested in other people's problems. And, well, I leave my belongings around. Is that a fancy way of asking, am I messy? right? I mean, what is that? And some questions that took a little bit more thought. Some of these are really good. I have a soft heart. Took about 4 minutes all in, Stephen Cobb on the phone the whole time. And after I finished, I sent the results his way.
Put that in my super secret file. Guy's brain. Here we go.
Great, great. I feel much better now. Tell me what you're looking at.
Okay, so there are five colored bars showing your raw score for each of five different aspects of your personality.
Yeah.
Sometimes called in papers the big five.
All right, so let's take it top down here, just as they are presented in this graph, which is factor one, extroversion. I got a 41 percentile. What does that mean? And yeah.
Yeah, so two ways of looking at it. Extroversion, you're low on extroversion.
Okay, wait. Is low on extroversion another way of saying I'm a little bit introverted?
That would be one interpretation.
which happens to be true, but that's neither here nor there, I suppose.
Well, I mean, this is the point, right? That short test reflects how you think you are, then this is why people use this. Emotional stability.
Factor two. And I'm just going to say this because I'm proud of getting a 94 on this. That seems good. I don't know.
That's the neuroticism score. So
it's not good?
Well, no value judgment here.
Yep.
This would be less calm and relaxed than on average.
Wow. Okay. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Okay. All right. So just if you're keeping score at home, it got me right on the extroversion thing. I like to think I'm pretty calm, but clearly this test says I'm not. So go to the next one. This is going to be interesting too.
Okay. So conscientiousness, you're in the 89th percentile.
Yes.
And that is well organized, is another term for that. You align very closely there with various different groups that I have studied, such as law enforcement and cybersecurity.
Military, perhaps? Military?
Military,
yeah,
yes.
I'm prior military, right? So that fits.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, interesting.
There were two other categories. I tend to be more competitive than agreeable, apparently, which was news to me. And it turns out I'm more traditional and small C conservative than artistic and small L liberal, which is probably true. Stephen explained all that to me, and then we got down to business. put this into the bigger picture of Cambridge Analytica and the data. And now that somebody might know this about me, if I took that test that Cambridge Analytica did and that was then used to hoover up all that data, how does this roll into all of that? And what can people, how I suppose can people manipulate me, right? That's the question.
Right. So if I've got this profile, that enables me to communicate more effectively with you, knowing, in a sense, the kind of person that you are. So 89th percentile on conscientiousness, I would target you with a strong message about responsibility, about structure, using images would evoke that. Combined with the emotional stability score, I would probably use sort of fear-oriented messaging with you, depending on what my research had shown, right? Yeah. And what happened with the basis for the whole Cambridge Analytica program was a collection of 270,000 people's results, right? So for you, I have this graph, and I have everything I can glean from your Facebook profile. If you are a statistician, an analyst, and you've got 270,000 people, you can run correlations up one side and down the other, and therefore you get the data from a whole bunch of other people who haven't taken the test, but you can imply things about them.
So let me dig in a little bit and ask you, if you, now that you know I'm conscientious and prior military, how does that, as Cambridge Analytica claims to have been able to do, how does that let you either influence or figure out how I'm going to vote?
First of all, you would take this knowledge and combine it with a bunch of other stuff. So just using your Facebook and your psychological profile results wouldn't be all that I would be using. So to discourage you from going to the polls, I might want to muddy the waters around whoever your candidate is. Then the message that I would use to do that would be shaped by what I know about your personality. And so perhaps, you know, former military, rules-based person, okay, your candidate broke the rules.
Yeah, and you would be judging my response the whole bleeping time, right?
Yeah, to the extent that I could, I would look for feedback from that. Did you share it?
Right.
And so I would, you know, over time, I would hone my messages.
Why do you think, as a guy who does this kind of thing for a living, why do you think this instance of consumers' data being used has struck such a chord?
I think that it has surfaced something which a lot of people have talked about and worried about, but it's been hard to bring people's attention to bear, the data aggregation, the data mining. A lot of the tools that were used are standard social science tools, standard marketing tools, but they were brought together in a way which some people feel was inappropriate.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, where does this fit in the order of things? Should we regulate that? Should we ban that?
Stephen Cobb. Stephen, thank you so much for your time and your observations about me and my personality.
Well, I appreciate you being such a, such a sport on this.
Good stuff. Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks.
In the interest of full disclosure here, I should say we put the results I got on this test up on our website, marketplace.org. So have a look if you like and be kind. Also, a link so you can take it yourselves. And remember, gang, there are no right or wrong answers here. Coming up,
TV writers were still being told, we don't really want to have a woman do that.
And that wasn't all that long ago either. First, though, let's do the numbers. There you go. There you go. I say it and it comes out your radio speakers. Dow Industrial is up 669 points today, 2.8%, 24,202. NASDAQ gained 227 points, about 3.2%, 72.20. The S&P 500 rose 70 points, 2.7%, finished at 26.58. Tech turned higher after last week's big drops. Microsoft firmed up 7.5%. Google's parent company, Alphabet, up 2.6% today. Bank stocks rose along with rising bond yields. Citigroup up 2.7%. Bank of America up 4.3%. Bond prices fell. When that happens, the yields rise. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.85%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
And we are back with our podcast, Make Me Smart, asking people the question that never fails to get a great answer.
I would say
eventually.
What is something that you thought you knew and then later found out you were wrong about? Take a moment, take a breath, think about it.
It's going to take a while.
Tell us your answers.
Check us out at makemesmart.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There is, deep in the new tax code that went into effect on January 1st, a section titled Opportunity Zones. In a nutshell, it's a program that uses tax incentives to bring private investment into areas of persistent poverty. It's not a new idea. It's been tried repeatedly for almost 40 years, but without a whole lot to show for it. What often happens is that these zones bring wealth into poor areas, but they don't necessarily create wealth within them in terms of helping people get out of poverty. So we sent Marketplace's Ryan Kailath to find out why try it again.
In Upper Manhattan in the Heights, there's this old theater kind of stranded in time. The Audubon Ballroom, built in 1912. It's got these grand columns and intricate carvings on the facade. It was a vaudeville theater, showed movies. Then in the 60s...
This is where Malcolm X was assassinated on February 21st, 1965.
In the 90s, NYU professor Kimberly Johnson was a grad student at Columbia University. Back then, the school wanted to tear the ballroom down to build lab space for its hospital. They'd been eyeing it for years, but now the Audubon was inside a newly created empowerment zone. And building anything there was suddenly much cheaper. But locals weren't having it.
This is a part of New York City history. It's a part of African-American history. So having this site erased struck people as really wrong.
But they were fighting a tide of redevelopment. For years, Upper Manhattan had been plagued by poverty and crime. By the 90s, it was changing, and the empowerment zone was seen as a tool to hasten that change. It included block grants, local hiring requirements, and tax incentives. Today, the neighborhood is transformed.
Restaurants and coffee bars and yoga places that, you know, in 1993, you just could not even imagine it.
But that's happened all over New York, from Brooklyn to Queens to the Lower East Side, none of which are in the empowerment zone. Tim Weaver of the University of Albany has written a book on the subject. He says the zone definitely sped up Harlem's gentrification, but that the new wealth trickled up, not down. He says the problem with poor neighborhoods is not that taxes are too high, but cutting taxes is always popular. Because of this...
The opportunity zone is really a zombie policy that's been staggering on for decades, despite its moribund performance.
He says the new opportunity zone program will be even less effective than the 90s empowerment zones, because it doesn't include local hiring requirements or direct cash grants. Steve Glickman of Economic Innovation Group helped design the new program.
There's no easy answer to the question around gentrification, but states and cities can create any number of additional requirements in their communities to ensure it works in the way they want it to.
He understands that cutting taxes for investors may not be the most direct way to help the poor. But he says,
if you're poor in a poor community, there's no hope. If you're poor in a prosperous community, you're many times more likely to climb the socioeconomic ladder.
And economic research proves this true. But Kimberly Johnson says addressing the underlying inequality would do even more to help the poor. Back at the Audubon Ballroom, we can't get in.
This is a space that was supposed to be for the community and it's not really accessible.
Columbia ultimately got its wish. The Audubon was turned into a 7-story research lab. The facade of the ballroom was preserved, and there's a Cafe X on the premises. Fresh pastries, hot coffee, locally owned.
Is that what Malcolm X kind of envisioned? Probably not, but it's nice, I guess.
So while many workers in the lab are white-collar transplants who moved to the neighborhood, the local hiring requirement was fulfilled. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
If you think back on television the past 5 or so years, it's been a good run for shows featuring strong central female characters, often shows that are written and produced by women as well. Timing, though, in that slice of entertainment has been a central part of the equation. Joy Press talks about women on TV in her new book. It's called Stealing the Show. Joy, welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
You are fairly emphatic in this book a couple of times about 2015. You started writing it in 2015. You say that that is, or was, I suppose, since it's a couple of years ago, an interesting moment in women and television. Explain why.
Well, I think it was one of the kind of recent moments where there were a number of shows kind of created by women that were very female-centric shows like Girls and Orange is the New Black mm-hmm. and Inside Amy Schumer, a sort of profusion of really different kind of female-centric shows than we'd seen before. And it felt like there was a critical mass building.
Let's go back a little bit before 2015, though. Not like Lucille Ball and Mary Tyler Moore back, but Murphy Brown, Diane English, and 1988, which is just amazing that it was so long ago. What was it about that show that made you honestly sort of want to start the book there? I mean, you give Lucille Ball and the rest of them their due, but you say, listen, here is where it actually starts, women on television as they live their lives.
I was really fascinated by the realization that Murphy Brown and Roseanne premiered in the fall of 1988, a month apart from each other.
Wow.
And you had these two characters on television who were absolutely fierce, said what they thought, were funny and angry and aggressive and assertive in very different ways. Murphy Brown was very elite, mm-hmm. single working woman who became a single working mom. And Roseanne, who was, you know, the matriarch of this very, very poor middle American family. And yet the two of them became lightning rods for the culture.
Tell me about Diane English, the woman behind Murphy Brown. I mean, she no holds barred, man. She just went for it and said what she thought.
She was a very extraordinary figure, and she had created the show that, you know, might not have happened the way it did if there hadn't been a writer's strike.
Yeah.
She created this sort of 40-something woman who was coming back from rehab, had had a lot of problems, and the network, I think, wanted a younger woman. They wanted her to be coming back from a spa.
Right.
They wanted her to be less unlikable. But the writer's strike meant that they had to decide, are they going to take it the way Diane English wrote it? Or yeah. are they going to wait?
And I mean, they couldn't change the pilot, right? Because the writers were on
strike. Yeah, they couldn't change it. They had to take it as written. And that really kind of changed TV history.
Explain that a little bit, right? Where? That's actually a great question, which I should have thought about myself. How did it change history, though?
There were very limited ways to be a woman on television. And I think really women at that point were still expected to be a little bit less kind of aggressive and angry.
Yeah.
And she was really an avenger. I mean, her job was, you know, to go after corporate bad guys and, you know, government cheaters. I mean, it feels like we could really use her right now.
That phrase is really interesting. How to be a woman on television. Because so much of it was sanitized.
Yes. And frankly, that was the thing that really surprised me as I was writing this book, because I bring it up to the present. And over again, I mean, as recently as, you know, 3-4 years ago, TV writers were still being told, we don't really want to have a woman do that. Or, people won't like that character.
That's amazing.
Yes.
I'm showing my naivete here, but that's crazy.
It's crazy. Well, even if you come up to the present, I have people say to me, why do I hate Lena Dunham so much? I can't stand the way she behaves. Part of it is we really have a lot of opinions you know, how women behave and what they look like. Anything that steps too far out of the norm makes us really uncomfortable.
What do you make, just to bring it back to where we started, what do you make of the fact that Murphy Brown and Roseanne are being rebooted now in 2018?
In some ways, it seems perfect. For the industry, it's nostalgia for those days when you could get everyone to watch.
Of course, the catch is now it's so fractured out there in television and streaming services that you're never going to get those numbers.
You're never going to get those numbers. But of course, it's the same with a franchise film where, the getting the name recognition and cutting through is part of the deal. And I think in this sort of post-Me Too moment, having these women who speak truth to power feels pretty exciting.
Joy Press. It's a book called Stealing the Show. Joy, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
This final note on the way out today, part news, part shameless self-promotion, and one of the last big legal actions from the financial crisis. This morning, the Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal by former AIG chairman Maurice Greenberg that the government acted illegally when it bailed out the firm in the midst of the financial crisis late in 2008. Greenberg lost an appellate court decision last year, so this one is done. I mention it because it is news, of course, but also as a way to, for the last time for a while anyway, point out that you can hear my hour-long interview with the three people who made the decision to bail out AIG. That would be Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke, and Tim Geithner. In a special podcast we have put in the Marketplace feed, or you can hear it at marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 669 today, 2.8%. NASDAQ up 227, 3.2%. S&P 500 up 70 points, about 2.7%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.